You're back.
I'm back. Okay. Are we good? We're good. We're recording.
Okay.
Just yap away to me there for a second, Neil.
So the lorry's gone now, but it was the classic Peter Donovan style interruption for our first call.
did you call me Peter Donovan?
Did I? Donegan, I thought I said. Yeah, I call you Peter Donovan. Whatever you want me to call.
Been called worse, Neil. I've been called worse. Okay. All right, let's try this.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
I was about to say it's another Friday afternoon. We've been here before. It's been happening to me for far too long at this stage of the game, but you are... I don't know why I paused there. You're very welcome to another episode of the Sideshow Garden Podcast. For anything you need at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/TheSideshow. Do people still use that thing? It's on the Instagrams and all of that. And my guest today is, we know each other by reputation, but how we met or when we last met happened during the middle of a... interview with Kate Gold on press day at Chelsea 2019, and here's that little bit of it.
Over a pint of Guinness, yeah. Obviously gin, yeah. For me, we will sing it gin, to you.
A pint of gin, yeah, indeed. The garden is for Green Fingers. We've got BBC.
I know, got BBC.
They're playing Delight Groove. What year is this?
1991.
Delight Groove, is that 1991?
Yeah,
it's a great song.
It's yeah. Live now.
Nice.
All right, okay.
Now, known to you, or maybe you couldn't pick it up, Neil was the voice, Neil Grant, that is, my guest who you're about to hear in a second. He was the voice in the background, and he sent me a note afterwards, because I'd forgotten all about it, because Welcome to Peter's Head, saying... I'm really sorry for interrupting your interview with Kate, but Neil, it's excellent to hear your voice again. How are you, my good man?
I'm good, thanks, Peter. Yeah, that was a funny incident. You don't remember because you were too busy thinking about jumping onto a net with Kate.
Yeah, well, I wasn't thinking about jumping onto a net with Kate because I'm scared out of my wits, to put a polite term on it, of heights. How and ever, Kate decided we should jump on a net, and that was that. Neil, for those who don't know you, I'm aware of how your Twitter bio reads, but what is it that you would do that you would be best known for?
I run a family garden centre on the outskirts of Sheffield. I do a garden phone-in on Radio Sheffield in this area, so I've been doing that for 14 years, so that's how most people know me. In our industry, they know me for wearing floral shirts, so, you know, people go, oh, you'll know Neil, he always wears a flowery shirt.
Right, okay. Well, to clarify Neil's reference to Sheffield, that's BBC Radio Sheffield that he would do it for, and I would be a regular, an irregular, I should add, listener to most of the local BBCs because the TuneIn app, if you're into your mobile phone things, allows me to listen to pretty much anything all over the world, including my good friends in 90.9 KRCL in Salt Lake City. Neil, talk to me a little bit about what you do in the garden centre, and for you listening at home, don't get me wrong, we have a rough plan of where I want to go with this conversation, but when I say garden centres, at least for me growing up, they seemed to have started, a lot of them anyway, if I go back to the 80s, where they were in back gardens, they were at the sides of houses, and then all of a sudden they sort of boomed more so and blossomed into something that became quite grand with more than one cash register or a till behind a wooden homemade bit of a shelf. And then they turned into something that is 4,000 car parking spaces, let's call it.
Yeah. Well, on the Big Island, as you call it, most of the garden centres actually formed out of nurseries, production nurseries. So they started to retail a bit and then people wanted some compost and so on. And really with the advent of plastic pots, really, in the 60s and 70s, it meant that people could buy plants when they wanted them in the spring and not have to wait until the winter. So, and then people want more and more. One of the big reasons that garden centres are very much lifestyle, and some of them with massive car parks, is that the people don't garden all year round like my grandfather used to do. So what do you do with your staff in the winter? What do you do with them in the autumn? Autumn as an industry is a big problem now, because people don't garden in the autumn. They don't buy stuff. They don't plant bulbs in the way they used to. Some do, but not many do. So that's why there's so much lifestyle gone down. But actually, perhaps your garden should be just part of your everyday life when the weather's reasonable and when you want to do it.
The International Garden Centre Congress, about five approximate years ago, if I remember it correctly, and I was brought on that tour speaking with garden centres from Australia and Germany and the United States, etc. But one of the things that I know here, there was a huge big deal made out of, and again, talking to garden centre owners over the course of those 3 days, they were explaining to me that they wear that little man and his wife, I jest in saying that, but I'm not far off the mark, out the back of the house to, as we said, now it is no longer Jimmy's garden centre, it is Jimmy's lifestyle and garden centre. They sell crystal, they sell jewellery, they have cafeterias. It's not a cafeteria, it's now a restaurant. You can buy suites of furniture. It's got everything. Is it a case of that garden centres had to do this because plant sales were on the decline? Why did all of this happen, Neil, outside of the off-season months?
It's a bit of both. It's plant sales actually are probably, certainly over here, as big as they've ever been when you do the job properly. But what's changed over the last 30, 40 years is overheads have changed dramatically. So, you know, you've got minimum wages, you've got higher insurance, you've got heating bills. They're completely different in the sense than they used to. Spring used to look after the whole year pretty much. I mean, you could make enough and keep going through from the spring. You can't do that anymore. There's just too many overheads. And of course, every time you've had a coffee shop, it increases overheads and so on and so on. A lot of environmental issues now, a lot of garden centres around the countryside, not on mains drains, and that's starting to become an issue over here in the water authorities. You have to register it all, so that it's becoming professional businesses, really, that's added the overheads.
How big is your own garden centre, Neil? How many staff do you employ? Do you have, in ratio of plant sales, let's say, to, I was about to say crockery, but that's not the correct term, but to, let's say, accessories and the crystal and the jewellery, etc.?
We employ about 60 people. They're not all full-time, a lot of part-time. And that just suits, you know, people with families particularly, that really suits them. I've got about 20 full-time staff. Coffee shop is not a coffee shop anymore. It's a restaurant, seats about 200. That keeps us busy. That's about a third of the business in turnover terms. But plants are also still, outdoor plants are still a third of turnover. And house plants are growing and becoming, going from 1% and 2% to about 3% or 4% again. So we're still very much focused on plants. We're actually plant nutters. And that, you know, every time a new lorry comes in, there's always a little crowd around, oh, what's on this one? When actually it means there's nobody in the garden centre, in the plant department. They're all out looking at the new delivery. So, but I actually think the essence of a good garden centre, even with lifestyle, you've got to still look at the plants and you've got to look after them, because it's the one thing that we can be unique at, looking after plants, doing it well, having new varieties, being a bit different.
Do you tie in then, Neil, with the rest of the, I say the rest of, but in general, if I was to contrast you with, say, five other garden centres within a 50-mile radius of you, is it a fair suggestion then that you may be renowned, let's say, for being a place to go should you want plants for your garden?
Yeah, I think there's a few others in the area as well. But, we particularly put a lot of effort and extra staff in the last few years to build that up. Because I think one of the things when garden centres started heavily, and in the 80s they had their massive boom years, was that they became a place for absolutely everybody. And that meant that quite often some garden centres went down the being, let's say, good value, for want of a better word. And so they were putting off the people who wanted things were a bit better, and eventually put off the people who knew they could buy it cheaper, as it happens perhaps now at the bargain stores or the market or so on. So we're starting to see garden centres become more focused on who their customers are. Because to be honest, you can't deal with everybody. You know, you get a busy day in the week or the weekend in spring, you just can't cope with the numbers. So more and more people are sort of saying, well, my customer goes to that supermarket, or and they live that style, they might have these cars. So it's getting much more professional than it used to be, just like a blunderbuss, scatter everything as far as you could get it.
One of the points that you made there, Neil, was on the houseplants, and you said they've gone from a 1 or 2% to a 3 or 4%. Well, I'll pause this one, in Peter's head, says you. But if I'm to look at the media furore of houseplants and how much it spoke about and how much it has been, and inverted commas, millennials and small spaces and London and all of those things that seem to come with it. If I pause that over there on the right-hand side of my brain, my medulla oblongata, if you want to use a long word and sound very intelligent, and I contrast it with a trend that we had maybe 10-odd years ago, the point we made off air, or at least I made to you, was I gave a card talk on garden trends of 300 years of garden trends is what it was, in fact. And when I looked at that and I took the grow your own epidemic, or pandemic as some people call it, the point that I made to you was there was a moment in time where McDonald's were giving away grow your own kits with Happy Meals, and I said in my head, this is peak saturation now. It won't get any higher than this. 1, 2, we've always gone to grow your own, or being more frugal, let's call it, at times of recession, of economic, that is. And when the boom comes back, instead of bringing back a packet of carrot seeds, we bring back a bunch of flowers. Have we seen another one of them in plant sales, number one? And number two, 1 and 2% to 3 and 4% actually doesn't seem to tie in with the media furore.
Well, it's never been, houseplants in garden centres has never been a very big department, because it tends to be small. The values are a bit lower. I think the one thing that's different with this change, with the growth and the millennial interest, is part of it is the publicity that's been given, because the people who are reporting are the same age, and so they got into it. They live in flats, probably in London. But actually, it's happened across the English-speaking world. So on Instagram, before it was hitting the newspapers, it was big. And I think one of the differences now, why it might carry on, is while ever millennials don't own gardens, then houseplants seems will be still very important to them. Now, if you also remember, in the 80s and 90s, we had certain big Swedish companies simplifying our houses completely, and they were getting you to chuck out anything that could collect dust. And the houseplants fell into that as well. And to be honest, in this country, garden centres ignored them, and they didn't push them hard enough. But it's so exciting, and we're finding it's not just millennials, it's all age groups. And, you know, we're doing bottle garden classes and workshops for people, and that age group goes right from classic millennials right through to retired people. It's just people are having fun. I think that's the difference. They're having a play and having fun, and the nurseries are starting to find things to sell that are interesting as well. Going on to the grow your own, though, I think that started because it looked like a good thing to save money. It was never going to do that because you can't produce things at the right time. It became a bit of fun, but the industry didn't back it up, because people started and they didn't get terribly good results, and we didn't pick that up quickly enough, so we weren't showing them how to make it better. I think it's growing again now, slowly, not for economic reasons, but for lifestyle reasons again. I thought you'd run out of euros for your meter.
You're not far off it. For those of you listening at home, we had a, I did run out of pounds for the meter, more so than the euros, but we'll park that to one side. You had made the point that you think that started because it looked like a good reason for people to save money, and it was never going to do that.
Yeah, okay. You can grow things to save money. If you've got an allotment, then fair enough, you could probably give yourself food for a lot of the year. But for the majority of people, they didn't have allotments or very big gardens now, so they were growing on the patio, but they didn't really know what they were doing, and we didn't back it up with trying to help them. And I think that's the big impact for gardening now, is the lack of knowledge out there is immense. I don't know if that's the right way of putting it, but the good thing about growing again, and I think why it's growing your own and it's coming back again, is that you've got control over what you're growing. But the biggest impact for me is that if you can get kids to start growing and eating their own tomatoes off a plant, then you start to get them into it becoming not part of their normal way of living. But I think as an industry, both from, you know, right up at the Chelsea Flower Show end, right down to social media pages, there's not enough concentration paid on actually showing everyday people how they can have success. It's just too much trial and error for too many people. And when you look at some of the Facebook groups that are giving advice, it's just plain wrong advice. And if you step in as a professional, you just get pilloried. You know, people just have a go at you for being globalists, and which has happened to me, and for representing the chemical industry and stuff. But the people are just, there's a lot of misinformation out there.
It's funny you should say that, Neil, because I was mildly, I'll be choosing my words here, but reprimanded may be a good word for suggesting that I sterilize my pots. And by my horticultural education, Milton baby fluid or Jay's fluid or one of them is always how I would have done it. There is what I would call good husbandry, where you sterilize your pots, you use clean compost, you do the basics extremely well, you sterilize your secateurs, you only take, when doing cuttings, for example, you only do it from good clean stock. You're almost heading towards when pruning an apple tree, where it's the removal of dead and diseased wood immediately, and then you go to the shaping of said tree, for example. In the sterilization of pots, is that something that you would recommend, or is it something that you stay away from?
Oh, absolutely, because I mean, the basic husbandry in horticulture has not changed. You know, when it was terracotta pots, and as an apprentice, your job in the winter was cleaning pots, which I'm amazed that people carried on in a career like that. They probably didn't have a choice. And actually, it'll become more important when we get, as we're getting more and more transfixed about the problem of plastics in horticulture, we'll end up with pots we want to keep a longer time. So we're going to have to sterilize them rather than chuck them away every year. So, but we're going to have to use things. The weird thing for me, Peter, is that at the moment over here, there's this massive impact and big discussion about recycling of pots from garden centers and the right materials, which is absolutely right. But it seems to have, again, gripped hold of the people in the media. Whereas all our kitchen cupboards are full of nasty chemicals in plastic bottles, which no one seems to be paying much attention to. So there's this sort of mix of what's good news and what's bad news and who can we have a go at, even though I don't think people really intend to. But we've got to keep the basic husbandry there. Otherwise, well, we'll have too many diseases anyway coming in, let alone the ones we've already got.
The point that was made to me, Neil, I should add, whilst I was on stage by a gentleman who has a garden centre, when I said about sterilising pots, now I was the host of the stage on this occasion.
Yeah.
I said, well, this is, you know, my education was to do it this way. You can choose to do it another way if you wanted. And he said, well, the science hasn't proved it. What I was suggesting, not suggesting, what I was saying, which is correct in my head, which we're in agreement on, but what? When did this all change? If you don't, or maybe for the listener at home, Neil, can you maybe clarify what happens if you use dirty compost, or sorry, reuse compost, which you think you're doing a favour to yourself or saving a few bob or being a bit frugal, and you don't sterilise your pots? What is the knock-on effect of that?
Well, particularly at seedling and cutting stage, is that the what I don't think many people know is, newer gardeners particularly, is that there are soil-borne diseases, Pythium, Phytophthora, those sort of things, which kill roots. So if you're going to start spend all, and in fact, when we at home, we spend most of our money at propagation time. So be parts compost, seeds, that's the expensive part of the process. If you're putting brand new healthy seeds into soil that might have these pathogens in there, the plants are never going to thrive. And from then on, they're never going to flourish in their whole life cycle. It's like, it's just like bringing kids up. I mean, if you don't change kids' nappies, they're not going to thrive. if you don't feed them properly, they're not going to thrive. And I'm one for always trying to turn plant growing into things people understand, because they go, oh, right, yeah, I get it. You know, they might not understand the Pythium and Phytophthora thing, but they'll understand clean and so on. Now, you get the odd funny thing. My dad years ago tried to grow some cyclamen from seed and didn't work. And being half Scottish, he decided to reuse the compost. And then, of course, they germinated the second time. And none of the next stuff germinated, but he got his cyclamen. But, I mean, generally, that's not normal.
Is that the point, though, Neil? When I speak about good husbandry and that famous book, that I had going through college, which was the principles of horticulture. In a nutshell, for you listening at home, it was the Bible of the things, literally the principles by definition that you should follow. But once you got those clicked inside your head, everything else seemed to follow quite simply afterwards. And it's only when, I think the famous one that I would get on Twitter a lot is, my seeds grew to 2 inches tall, then they keeled over and died. And I and you would know that as damping off, which comes from the basics, the really very basics of not sterilizing your seed trays and or using dirty compost. It's a phenomenon if you aren't aware of it, but it's quite simple to understand if you have studied horticulture and you've got that in. Is that the bit that's missing, Neil, in the inverted commas, the information that's being put out there?
There's those basics. There's the basics on nutrition. There's just a simple understanding of soil types, shade in the garden. But look, Peter, the way I relate it to people on my phone is to say, when you're learning to cook, you have to get some basics. One is hygiene. One is learning to make things. Apparently, there's something, I'm not a cook, so there's something out there called a roux. Now, apparently, once you know how to make a roux, you can make all sorts of sauces. Please don't ask me to tell you how to do that. I just heard about it. But if people start to understand that you get a few basic cooking skills, you can go on and do as much as you want. If you get a few basic gardening skills, hygiene, all the, you know, how to do things, when to do things. I mean, it keeps me in a job on a Sunday because people can ring in and ask the questions, and I say to them, well, if you don't know, just ring in. But people, they want it. There is a big hunger for information now. That's one thing about the millennials. They won't just accept you do it now. They want to know why you do it now. And I think that's good. But I don't know how we're going to, as an industry and as nations, get that basic knowledge back in. I mean, two big inspirations in my life for gardening were my grandfather, who had a classic Victorian garden, you know, greenhouse, small vegetable plot, a little bit of grass, a crazy paving patio, although we didn't call it a patio in those days. We were never allowed to touch anything, but this thing was a work of art. And then, weirdly, the other one was the Good Life TV program in the 70s, which just made me think, there's a different way of doing these things. Now, we were brought up with a bit of knowledge. We had family around. People who had allotments would learn from the people on the next allotment. But we've got a massive gap. That doesn't exist anymore. And if one is an industry, we can keep showing lovely things at Chelsea and inspire people, Chelsea and Cardiff and, you know, Tatton and Chatsworth. But at the same time, people go, well, that's just for there. I can't do that. I'd love to do that, but I can't do it because the knowledge in there. So it's a big concern of mine for the future, to be honest.
There's a part in my head, Neil, which says, Peter Donegan, not to make me sound grandiose and greater, and for I am the El Guapo, etc., etc., but when when I take my career, having grown plants under my bed, cliche bingo you say at home, age 6, having done my first garden, age 9, having worked through garden centres and landscaping from 16, 15, 14 upwards, having been out cutting grass at 7 years of age, whatever way you want to take it, to go and study horticulture for 4 years, to go and do what I want to do, and then I've got a gentleman, in fact, it happened last week, who apparently watches YouTube videos on how to garden, and he's telling me that, no, you're wrong, because I read this or saw this or watched this on the internet. I suppose with the phone in hat on, number one, but number two, being the face of your own garden centre, which you have operated and run for an elongated period of time, are you told at any point in time that you're wrong because of X?
Well, not straight to my face as much, but you can, particularly when you're face to face with somebody, you can tell they don't believe you. And I often say to people, you don't believe what I'm saying, do you? Because I'm a bit loud and a bit upfront sometimes, and you know, and I push them a bit to say, well, what is it that we're not connecting on? But I think that's becoming a massive problem. That experts generally, I gather from the media, aren't trusted. So, you know, because they think there's a vested interest all the time. Well, my vested interest is I just want to have people have fun with plants and gardening. Particularly the plant side. I mean, there's so many amazing plants out there. That's why we always end up around the toys when the delivery's coming, because we're just nutters about it. But yeah, I think it is an issue. But you have to build trust with everybody. I think the starting point for everybody nowadays as an expert is, I don't trust you, prove yourself to me. So 14 years on the radio, probably starting to do that.
It was actually the question I wanted to ask you at the very, very start, but when was the first time you ended up on radio and how did that happen?
Well, it happened when I happened to bump into the curator of the Botanical Gardens in Sheffield, who in those days did a half-hour gardening program, like a magazine program. It's they don't produce things like that now. And he'd come into the garden centre, and I think he could see that I'd got good horticultural knowledge. Well, Linda, my wife, and I met at Rittle Agricultural College in Essex, and then he invited me to do snippets on that. And then that faded, and somebody else did the. They started a phone in. Unfortunately, the presenter was ill, and they said, "Can you come and cover?" And I'm still there 14 years later. So I think in all these things, it's who you know a lot of the time and who you've bumped into, and which is why I'm still in Sheffield and not doing anything national, because national doesn't come into Sheffield very often.
I'm laughing with you, not at you.
I know you are.
Have you dabbled into the show side of things, Neil, outside of the reporting from there?
I have worked. When I was a student at Rittle, we had a year's industrial placement, which you probably did, and I worked for a nursery in Surrey called L.R. Russell's. It just earned their 50th gold in a row. It's reputed that the nursery end at Lord's was their original nursery before they moved out to Surrey. And I worked for 2 days on the Chelsea stand as a student and met people like George Harrison and lots of other well-spoken people who I have no idea who they were, because that was a big shop window in those days, and we were taking orders left, right and centre for dispatch. Having then done radio, I've also worked with Raymond Everson on their show stand at Chelsea a couple of times. Never down the garden producing side, but the more I listen to your shows, there's no way I'd ever enter into doing it. But I love the shows.
Why, Neil, what has made you turn around and say, no, I'm glad I never, and nor do I want to?
Well, it clashes time-wise. All these shows clash with the busiest time of the garden centre. You know, garden centres take something like a third to 45% of their annual turnover in a 13-week period between March and June, and you know how the shows sort of come thick and fast, particularly towards the end of that period. I mean, I'd love to, but I think that the more I look into it, the more I listen to you, watch people like Mark Gregory, the more I realise this is a specialist job that, great if you start and you can build up, but I'd much rather commentate on them nowadays and give opinions. But yeah, one day I think I would have fancied doing it, but I don't think I'll ever do it now.
I want to bring you just a little bit sideways, Neil, if I can. It's not a bear bug. Is that a right terminology? But a gripe. Not a gripe. I don't get irate. I tend not to get upset. I have 4 sisters and 3 brothers. I'm the lower of the middle child. I'm the quietest man. Eternally happy is how I would note it on my Twitter bio. At the same token, unless you rob my falafel, which is made of cornettos and cornflakes, you're pretty much safe in my department. And don't touch my pint of Guinness while you're at it. There is and has been a lot of reporting, but from the Monty Dons and the Alan Titchmarshes of this world, who tend to come out and say, well, children should garden more. I would see that on 2 levels, which is, number one, my daughter, nor your daughter, is reading the Daily Telegraph nor the Guardian. So you can say all you want, but those headlines seem to be directed to the mom and the dad rather than to the daughter or the person under 20 years of age. So it doesn't really make a difference, but congratulations, you've just got an entire page to yourself with a lovely photograph of you at the top of it, as yeah, far as I'm concerned. You, on the other hand, set up the National Children's Gardening Week, which says, as far as I'm concerned, pretty much the same thing, except for Neil Grant tends not to grab the headlines as much. Have I appraised that relatively sanely?
Yeah, I think you have.
Bear with me, Neil, just for 1 minute. And that is where we are going to leave this episode just for the minute. Neil will be on probably in True Sod Show style, you say, not next week, but the week after. And we will continue on this impromptu chat. We could have discussed a little bit more in the usual, what do you do for a living type thing and where did it all start? But maybe I think because myself and Neil know each other a little bit better, it allows me to skip on past that and give you, the listener, a little bit more of what you want to hear. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you're stuck for anything, at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/TheSideshow, sideshow.com. And it's available in all good podcast stores, etc., etc. Have a great weekend. I was about to say, in the great outdoors. We'll talk next week.